Today on Athens News Matters, the state of the pandemic in Athens, how prepared local healthcare infrastructure is, and the public health risk of sending kids back to school.
There is no good answer right now. And I have a lot of compassion and empathy for the decision makers in these school districts because it is so difficult.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Also today, booksellers, publishers, and authors will take a deep dive into how the pandemic economy is affecting the literary industry in Athens.
It's been hard to sit at my writing table and focus 100% on the story that I'm writing because I keep having this voice in the back of my head like the world is changing.
Those stories, our panel on the Week in News, and more coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition goes to the source, to the people affected by the news.
This plant could shut down, and a lot of very good people could lose their jobs.
Like this, it's completely ridiculous that we should feel unsafe to go to school.
I'm Noelle King. For stories that matter to you, listen every weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Coronavirus cases in Georgia continue to rise, presenting a new set of challenges for educators as schools grapple with how and when to reopen. Here to help us unpack some of the issues facing our communities is Dr. Grace Bagwell Adams, an associate professor and assistant dean for outreach, engagement, and equity at the University of Georgia College of Public Health. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Chris. Glad to be here.
Well, last week, Georgia saw the largest amount of deaths per day since May. Do we know what's driving the rise in cases?
Well, we simply are not doing anything to curb the spread. At this juncture, there's no real policy implemented that is designed to curb the spread. All that we have is a strong encouragement to wear masks from state-level agencies in the state government. We have lots of folks who are going to the beach. We have lots of folks who are moving around the state. And quite frankly, I think lots of people who are acting as if the pandemic isn't happening.
So certainly the wearing or not wearing of masks is part of the issue at this point. What other steps do you think would be important towards mitigating the spread of the coronavirus?
I think there's only so much that individuals can do right now. I think the focus right now really has to be on the systemic response to the pandemic. One of the most concerning things right now is the turnaround time that we are seeing for COVID-19 testing being conducted by the Department of Public Health. This testing, which is the nasal swab, the PCR testing, I'm hearing locally right now in some cases is taking 7 to 12 days for people to get their results. And when it takes that long, it really renders the test of very little effect in terms of us being able to do contact tracing, for example, in a timely manner. I think that the most important thing right now is that we focus on really figuring out what in the world is happening with this turnaround times for our labs, because it's crippling our community's ability to respond and to get a handle on this community spread. The other thing I think that we have got to pay attention to is just hospital capacity. We don't have enough resources locally. This is another systemic response, but we really need state-level resources to come to our region. Since Friday of last week, July 24th, we have had 0 to 1 beds available in our critical care units in our hospitals that serve many, many counties and over 600,000 patients. And so we really need some resources locally, and I'm not just talking about beds. I'm talking about physicians and respiratory therapists and the other resources that need to come here. And then we've got to realize that we're about to have another huge influx of people because of the return to campus. We're about to have 40,000 individuals come back to Athens Clark County. And I am extremely worried what that is going to do to the strain on our hospital and public health infrastructure.
You know, there are a number of people who have said that schools need to reopen for in-person instruction as soon as possible and that continuing virtual learning is harmful to students. Can you talk about some of the issues that schools and school districts are facing when it comes to reopening, as well as this idea that virtual learning is harmful?
Yeah, it really is an impossible problem. No matter what, there is risk. Okay. So it is clear that if we send our children to school and the current rates of positive testing that we're seeing, you know, right now, about 10 to 15% of tests statewide that are conducted are coming back positive. And that rate is far above what we would want to see in order to reopen schools safely. You know, there's risk there. There's also risk, you know, let's face it, there are lots of vulnerable families who, for example, their children, you know, depend on the breakfast and school lunch each day that they receive at school. It is so clear that this problem, there is no good answer right now. And there, I have a lot of compassion and empathy for the decision makers in these school districts because it is so difficult. But when possible, I think that we have to use the evidence base that we have to make the best decision. And even though a very small percentage of cases in terms of COVID deaths have been pediatric cases, there have still been cases where children have died. And when you look at even a very small percentage of cases, but spread that across a large state population like the state of Georgia, then we're still looking at the fact that we could lose many children to this virus. We just don't know. And so I think that the most important thing that decision makers in school districts can do is to use the best evidence that they have and the local data that they have and look at their test positive rate. And if their test positive rate is somewhere at 10% or above, it really is not safe enough to reopen schools at that juncture. And if you do reopen schools, prioritizing ventilation as much as possible, even outside learning, doing as much as you can to protect children with face masks and face shields. You know, if you do make the decision to go ahead and bear the risk as a school district, then the most important thing you can do is, again, use the tools we have at our disposal, use the evidence base that we have to protect the children within the school walls as best as you can.
Dr. Grace Bagwell Adams is an associate professor and assistant dean for outreach, engagement, and equity at the University of Georgia College of Public Health. Thanks for joining us as always.
Thank you, Chris.
Workers who have lost their jobs due to the pandemic have seen larger unemployment checks thanks to federal funding. Now, with that $600 per week scheduled to end, those who are still unemployed are worried about making ends meet. Jean Davis has that story.
More than 30 million Americans will see their incomes drop by up to 75% after federal unemployment benefits expire on Friday. The additional $600 that was added to state unemployment amounts was a prominent feature of the CARES stimulus package passed by Congress in March that went into effect in April. Christy Henry is a manager and server at The Grit who has been receiving unemployment benefits since her hours were reduced as the restaurant shifted to takeout only.
Even while all of these things are going on in our society, specifically as it pertains to the pandemic, I haven't felt anxious about money because I've been receiving that set amount. So it's helped me feel comfortable. It's been a mental bedrock to rely on.
Because the majority of people who lost their jobs were low-wage workers, the average person who has received unemployment benefits since the CARES Act went into effect makes one-third more than what they were earning before. Alpha Smith was a sophomore at the University of Georgia, making about $200 per week for working 25 hours at the Georgia Center as a banquet server. Now he's making $650 per week on unemployment. The federal money has enabled him a level of financial security that he wasn't able to experience before as a financially independent full-time student.
This upcoming semester, I am extremely ahead. Like any book expenses that I might have, I have at least 2 months worth of rent and utilities and phone bill and just groceries, anything that I could possibly need. I have that up front, which to me feels amazing because in previous semesters, that was not the case. I was literally living check by check.
Henry estimates that she is receiving 2.5 times more money than she was making at The Grit. She's been donating and saving portions of her benefits as well as buying things that were out of reach before.
Oh, I can get more food and a higher quality of food. I can afford to do that. I have been using it to buy things that aren't essential, but having them will allow me to do a lot of things. Like I invested in a new computer, which as a digital artist is like huge for me. I mean, this is the first time and since I worked 2 jobs that I've been able to financially plan, because I usually don't have any money to financially plan with.
The purpose of these benefits is partially to provide the essentials for out-of-work Americans. But economists also bank on recipients spending their money. Matt Gorin, an assistant professor of financial planning at the American College of Financial Services, explains how it's in the best interest of everyone to make sure the unemployed still have enough money.
Right now, we've got up to 15% of the American workforce who's unemployed. If those people all suddenly stop paying their bill or stop buying things, that wouldn't just be something the rest of us shrug our shoulders. Too bad for them. It's a massive disruption of our entire economy. Someone loses their job and can't pay their rent. That landlord's not receiving income and might not be able to pay their mortgage. And if the bank isn't receiving mortgage payments, it can't loan money out to the small business owner who would have otherwise hired someone and placed orders for supplies.
The Senate adjourned on Thursday without renewing the expiring government benefits, though it could still be added to the new stimulus package later. Republican Senator Rob Portman from Ohio has suggested adding a $450 return-to-work bonus in its stead.
The mindset that Portman has and many other members, particularly of the Republican Party, have is we've got all these people sitting around on unemployment who want to be unemployed, who don't want to work, that there are all these wonderful jobs out there that they would be taking, except that the unemployment benefits are so high.
As unintuitive as it sounds, studies have actually shown that despite the $600 a week benefits, employers saw more applicants per vacancy after the CARES Act was implemented, even among lower wage jobs. Unfortunately, there just aren't that many jobs out there right now, especially in the service industry, a fact that Henry has been grappling with.
There is not going to be a lot of work available just because of shift availability. I'm not going back to work exclusively because the $600 is ending, though I think it did a very good job at being what it was supposed to be, which was a financial disincentive to be put into pandemic conditions.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Jean Davis.
WUGA supports the educational mission of the University of Georgia. Internships are available each semester in radio programming, production, news, and social media for students currently enrolled in college-level study. Information at WUGA.org or 706-542-3324.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. Joining me now to discuss the week in news and politics are Gwen O'Looney from WXAG and Blake Odd from Flagpole Magazine. So former Superintendent Damon Means received a sizable settlement, several hundred thousand dollars.
$637,500.
Well, Blake, you have the specifics down. Why don't you fill us in a bit?
Well, there's the $409,000 that they owe him because there's a 23 months left on his contract, and he makes $209,000 a year because they renewed his contract in the summer of 2019, extended it, I should say, for 3 years. $92,000 for lawyer fees, and the rest is for damages. And in exchange for that, he has agreed to not sue the district and to withdraw an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission complaint that he apparently had filed.
This is not surprising to me. When we asked Russ Kreider to leave, our contract only it paid him for the rest of the contract, but it stopped when he took a new job. And I'm surprised that this contract goes for the full term, even if he is able to get a new job, because damages is usually proven by your inability to move on easily. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, anytime that you're in a negotiation like this, I mean, it all comes down to sort of a analysis of how much is it going to cost me to defend this in court, and what are my odds of winning or losing? That's usually just how it goes. It's math. But I am surprised that it took this long. I mean, you know, this goes back to November. He's been on administrative leave since December, and now it's almost August, and this saga is finally over with.
I'm glad. I think The other thing, the only other thing you didn't mention, Blake, is the closure. And like you're saying, since this has gone on since November, we really needed closure on the means and to move on. I will again give a vote of thanks and support to Dr. Thomas, who has done an excellent job of stepping in at a very hard time in handling this well.
Well, let's move on briefly to talk about the upcoming election, since we're less than 100 days out. What do you guys think, I guess, overall about November?
I think it's sad that we have set this up to where the election for a senator, as important as that is to our country right now, one of our senatorial races will not be decided until January. I think that's not good. I think that's negligent.
And which race are you speaking about, Gwen?
The race for the second U.S. senator, the one that replaces Johnny Isaacson. But we've got two senators up at a time when our nation is right on the brink of deciding the control of the Senate. So you know we are going to have floods of money into this state, and it's being handled, I think, terribly as far as the calendar is concerned.
Well, that's just the state law, though. I mean, that's how it's always been in Georgia, where when we have these special elections, you know, it's a jungle primary in November, and then we have a runoff. I'm not saying that's the right way to do it, but that's just the law.
Well, I think we found out with Jesse Hill that we need some changes in those laws.
Yeah. I don't think that'll happen because I think it's an advantageous process for Republicans, because if you have a runoff in January, Democrats have a long history of not turning out for runoffs. So I think that's a big advantage for either Loeffler or Collins, whichever of the Republicans emerges from that. Especially with the Democratic side kind of fractured. I know the party establishment is united behind Warnock, but the last poll I saw actually had Matt Lieberman ahead.
Yeah.
That's probably just name recognition, and that may change. But, you know, it just doesn't seem like any of the Democrats are really getting a lot of traction right now. So
you can't even find out information about the second senatorial race. I'm sure that will get more visible in November, but it is.
Well, Loeffler and Collins have all kind of ads up now, and people have been covering that race. But you know, there's a narrative there. You know, the Democratic side is just so unsettled right now that I don't even, you know, it would just be very hard to cover. Like what? I mean, it's just got to sort itself out a little bit more, it seems like.
And also, before we go, let's touch on the commission voting to move up last call in Athens-Clarke County.
Yeah, this is something that's in response to the really frightening spiking COVID numbers that we're seeing, where our numbers in Clarke County have quadrupled in the past 4 weeks. We've gone from 400 to 1,600 in the month of July.
That is shocking.
We've had at least two deaths in the past week as well. And a lot of the students haven't even come back. You know, some are back, but many more will be returning in August. And so the idea behind this is that, you know, when, you know, a lot of college students, the ones who are here, they've been congregating at the bars, not social distancing. You know, filling them over capacity, the limited capacity that they're supposed to have. And they usually go out late. And so the idea behind this is that if you cut it off at 10 o'clock, you know, that's before most students even go out. So maybe they won't go out as much, or if they do go out earlier, they won't consume as many beverages as they would otherwise. You know, it'll still be daylight out for the most part. Maybe they'll be a little more responsible. And that still allows for the people who are responsible to go, you know, get a happy hour beer and sit on the patio, socially distance from each other. you know, which is not terribly dangerous the way that packing inside a bar is, or packing close to each other on the sidewalk with no masks. So it's a safety measure, and you know, and it's to, you know, a lot of bartenders aren't happy about it. I mean, they're going to lose some money, they're going to lose some tips, but it also might save their life. You know, this is for the health of service industry workers as well.
You know, when we used to close at midnight, the great burden fell upon our police about these private clubs and private homes and small parties. It spread what was downtown all over the county. You know, young people are gonna go out. I hope that this doesn't. I hope that it brings home to them the seriousness of COVID. But I think it will make an extra burden on police. The other thing that happened last time was, no matter whether they'd had a drink or not, and in this case, when we were closing at midnight, they'd had a lot of drinks. And then when we closed, they'd jump in their car and drive to Atlanta that didn't close till 4 a.m. But I applaud our commission. We've been aggressive. We've been science-based. I applaud our commission.
Well, I would submit that everyone has gotten a lot more serious about drunk driving since the 90s.
That's true.
And the penalties are much, much stronger.
Good point.
But, you know, if they do, I think having a house, you know, it's not great by any means. You know, it's actually terrible. But, I mean, I do think having a house party is probably not quite as bad as, you know, a couple hundred people packing into a bar. If you have 30 or 40 people in a house and a lot of them are going to be outside, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm being Pollyanna-ish here, you know, but I don't think that's quite as awful. You know, we can't lock them up in their apartments or in their dorm rooms. But if they don't act right, then they're just going to get sent home and the university's going to shut down because the spike is going to get even worse.
The numbers are already alarming, just, you know, watching the spikes. And in the past couple weeks, the numbers have shot up incredibly. Yeah. But you're right, just the month of July alone, the increases are like nothing we've seen before.
Yeah, and I mean, if the students come back and they act like everything is normal, then, you know, probably by the end of September, then the university will be shut down again.
Well, I didn't want to end on a down note, but that's our time for this week. Gwen, did you have a positive addition before we go?
Well, again, I think our commission has shown a level of leadership far above our governor.
I'll take it. That is all the time we have for this week. I do want to thank my guests, Blake Aud from Flagpole Magazine and Gwen O'Looney from WXAG.
Some things you don't really have to question. If you want to believe the dog in that viral video was cooking spaghetti, you go for it. But how your decisions this November will affect your community, that is worth really thinking about. On your NPR station, you get reporting that informs your decisions and challenges what you think you know, because some things are worth that extra mental energy. 2020 election, it's time to listen.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. Athens is the home of a rich literary community, fostered by local authors, independent bookstores, and publishers. Even as the coronavirus pandemic threatens local economies and disrupts social norms, Athens' literary scene hasn't retreated since the beginning of the pandemic. They're just figuring out new ways to operate. We catch up with how the local literary industry is weathering the pandemic economy, and we start with a look at how authors are coping with the pandemic, and this report from my colleague, Chris Shoup.
As local governments begin enacting shelter-in-place orders and worker bees confined themselves to the home, a pressure to make the most out of newfound free time came with it. It was everywhere. Tweets announcing Shakespeare finished up King Lear while quarantining from the plague, even the First Lady telling the nation to spend time on a long-lost hobby. But this pressure to channel the uncertainty of the pandemic into something grand and productive just isn't working for some creators, like writer Rob White.
It's been hard to sit at my writing table and focus 100% on the story that I'm writing, because I keep having this voice in the back of my head, like, the world is changing.
White is one of several founders of the Athens Writers Association, an informal collective that would host workshops, critique groups, and readings before its indefinite hiatus in 2019. White described his current creative output as filled with, quote, a little desperation. He just hasn't found his groove yet. He said isolation of quarantining has had a strange effect on writers' perception of workflow and productivity. There's this notion that a surplus of free time can either ignite a writer's creativity or leave them flat on their backs.
You know, you go through your life and thinking like, oh, if I only had more free time, or if I only didn't have this, you know, this pressure or this other pressure, including social pressures, you know, including like looking at a calendar and thinking like, oh, I have so many events to go to. And now we're in that spot where not only are those events not on my calendar, but I don't have the capacity to make them. I don't have the ability to plan with somebody to go out on a Friday night or to sit in a coffee shop and write.
The pandemic hasn't entirely halted Athens' writing community. Writing collectives are still hosting readings, workshops, and critique groups like the Word of Mouth Poetry Group, which has led open mic nights through Zoom. But for White, it's just not enough. There's something inimitable about the energy of bodies in a room together, writing in a frenzy.
So much of my creativity comes from being around the table with other people. We had these things called write-ins, where once a week we would just sit around a table and bring our laptops or our notepads or whatever and just write. But being at a table with other people while that creative energy is taking place, it often felt like it was jump-starting my own. And missing that now has been, I don't know, like it feels like there's a bigger gulf missing from my life than I expected.
Athens area author Amy Bonifons has stayed connected to the community by holding virtual writing workshops and participating in readings for her latest novel. They're engaging and lively, she said, a way to creatively approximate virtual spaces. Bonifons' perception of productivity has shifted. She's embraced the idea of not putting pressure on herself to produce a certain number of words or a publishable product, but to journal and record what's going on in the world and how it's landing with her. She's going to want those notes later.
Creativity is, I think it's a cyclical process. It's a process that, you know, where you have surges of energy and then there's moments where things are kind of dormant or resting or just sort of germinating or gestating. What I've discovered in my, you know, decade plus of trying to be a writer is that you really can't force it.
Showing up can mean researching for a project, going on a walk to fill your well with imagery, or even daydreaming. That time doesn't have to be optimized. Use it for thinking, taking in your surroundings, and being receptive to change. Sure, Shakespeare finished off Macbeth or Antony and Cleopatra during quarantine, but he relied on wealthy patrons and wasn't distracted by the spoils of modern technology.
It just feels really important to record what's happening, because we're in such a time of massive change, not only, you know, physical change and societal change, but I think a lot of us are undergoing emotional and spiritual changes as a result of those. And so it just feels important to be attentive to that. And that's become my main priority more than actually producing anything.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Gemma DiCarlo. A shelter-in-place order might sound like an ideal situation for the book publishing industry. More time spent at home might encourage readers to begin reading and writers to wrap up projects they've put off for years. But quarantine isn't necessarily a publishing utopia. Bookstores have temporarily shut their doors, for one, and publishers have delayed the release of new books, canceled promotional events, and laid off staff. That's definitely been the case for the larger publishers. But what about smaller, independent publishing houses without a large corporate backing and network? Publishers like Deeds Publishing, based in Athens.
Interestingly, the COVID-19 hasn't hurt us, because as long as you can sit with your laptop computer, doesn't matter where you are, you can get the work done. You know, we don't care where an author is, because with the electronics, with email, with Zoom, with phone calls, you can be in next door, or you can be on the West Coast or wherever.
That's Bob Babcock, the CEO of Deeds Publishing, which specializes in nonfiction military history, memoirs, and coffee table books. Amid bookstore shutdowns and declining print sales, Deeds hasn't suffered, he said. Their operations have changed only to satisfy social distancing measures. Submissions have increased too, and he expects them to continue increasing into the fall.
I think COVID-19 is going to help the publishing industry, because people who are bottled up in their homes looking for something to do are finding time now that they didn't have before, versus being bored to death, they'll start writing.
That optimism is a contrast from independent bookstores, which sit at the opposite end of the supply chain, and larger commercial publishers with hefty overhead costs. Another Athens-based publishing house, Bilbo Books, hasn't had to take any cost-cutting measures, though it has noticed the overall publishing process slowing down. Here's Bowen Craig, the co-founder of Bilbo.
Print times with the printers we're using are longer, sometimes three times as long right now, just because they can't have as many people inside the actual building as they could pre-pandemic. And I totally understand that, but because time is not as much of a constant as we may think it is. In fact, I think time seems different now than it did in January. All aspects of it are slowed down, but not egregiously so.
There are clear challenges presented to smaller publishers. They're very much at the mercy of the workflow of writers. And if writers are discouraged from writing the great American novel because of financial hardship or shifting priorities, they're out of luck.
I think we are seeing some people who, or it's more complex than that. Some people who put off something for a while finally have the time to do it, but that really depends more than anything on an author's financial situation. Because if you have to work right now, then you have to work. Feeding your family is still more important.
Bowen doesn't believe the pandemic will permanently impact the publishing industry, at least in a way with lasting consequences. It's easy to predict the pandemic to change consumer habits, particularly when choosing to buy locally as opposed to Amazon, which the industry calls the 600-pound gorilla in the room. But the death of the book is far off, he said, and the industry will outlast the virus.
I don't think you can ever kill the bookstore. With each piece of new communication technology in the 20th century, they predicted the death of the book. With the radio, with TV, Lord knows with the internet, and it hasn't happened. People cherish books. People put books under their pillow in a way they don't with Kindles. Books aren't going anywhere, because as much as this is predicted every time. And I don't know, it's one of those sort of repeating zeitgeist news stories that is crazy to people who are in the industry, because it never actually happens. Books are so important to who we are, especially in a college town, that I think there'll be one of the things that can remind us that we're a resilient people, that we can get through something as immense as a global pandemic, something I couldn't even wrap my head around a year ago, and now is an omnipresent reality. I just think it's a celebration of life, lack of a better term.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Gemma DiCarlo.
And I'm Savannah Sicarella. Let's say 5 years ago, one could come into Athens and choose between a handful of bookstores to find a title they were looking for. There was Avid Bookshop, which opened its second location in 2016, or Jackson Street Books, and years later, Normal Books, if they wanted to find publishers overstock. There was Barnes & Noble, too, the last of the big bookstore chains in the city. For textbooks, they could choose between Baxter Street Bookstore or Beat the Bookstore. More came, and more went, and life happened. Out of all of those mentioned bookstores, only one independent store remains, the Five Points location of Avid Bookshop. And Normal Books, they were the most recent to go. After 2 years of operation, the bookstore shut its doors on July 20, citing the unexpectedness of the coronavirus pandemic as the reason for its closure. Mary Eaton was a co-owner of the bookstore.
We were only 2.5 years in. That's still the growth stage of any business. And every day counts. And for every day that you lose, you know, it takes two or three to catch up. It went on and on, and it just reached a reached the point where a decision had to be made, that it's just not going to be sustainable. The growth is not going to catch up to the amount of time lost.
When Normal Books first opened, Eaton says she could feel brick-and-mortar bookstores were on the brink of a revival, much like vinyl records. Normal had to adapt its business model to better fit the community's expectations from independent bookstores, like relying more on events than print sales, but they never ventured into online sales. They just didn't have the labor for it. Avid Bookshop, early on, implemented an online platform, which saved them when businesses started shutting down after shelter-in-place orders. Prior to the pandemic, most of the web orders were for in-store pickup, but now they rely almost entirely on orders fulfilled through their website and affiliate sales through bookshop.org. They're breaking even now. Avid has diversified the ways in which customers can online shop, however. One can browse recommendations provided by booksellers or choose by vibes, yes, vibes, like Beyond Murakami or Women in the Offbeat Workplace. Or they can take part in the Avid Snail Mail Surprise, where a customer fills out a form with their age and interests, and booksellers will mail out a personalized recommendation. Here's Janet Geddes, the founder of Avid Bookshop.
We beefed up our website a lot, and a lot of the joy of shopping in an independent bookstore is all the spontaneous discovery, how you see a book that you might not have ever heard of otherwise. We also focus on recommendations from our staff, so people who are very well-read and also very smart. So we're really good at recommending books to people face-to-face, and we can't be face-to-face right now. So we are inventing all of these clever ways to, as closely as possible, mimic that experience of spontaneity and surprise and joy and matching the right book to the right reader. We're just thinking about all these ways to connect people in a time when they really, really need it, and those social interactions are at a minimum.
Avid staff are using this time for creative planning and experimentation with silly ideas for two reasons: to make sales survive and to revive a sense of community connection. Preserving that connection, among other reasons, is going to help independent bookstores ride out a plateau or downturn of sales.
I think that cliche, a rising tide lifts all boats, is a cliche for a good reason. And I think that the more attention Bookshop and other independent bookstores can get in terms of news coverage and customer support and financial support, the more all of us are going to do better. It's important to Avid's health that all other independent bookstores do well. Yeah, we'll see what happens, but I'm hoping that this is a huge wake-up call for all of us and for those of us who really want to proactively think about and plan for the world that we're going to live in post-COVID.
Both Geddes and Eaton are hopeful that brick-and-mortar independent bookstores will survive in their communities.
I don't know if it can get back, but I certainly hope it does. Because, I mean, there's just some things that there's no substitute for. And I think books and holding one in your hand, that's one of them.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Savannah Sicarella.
And we should note that both Avid Bookshop and Bilbo Books are financial supporters of WUGA.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. By now, we all know that wearing a face mask is one of the easiest and most effective ways to contain the spread of the coronavirus. But it's not always the best thing for your skin. Many people, including some of us here at Athens News Matters, have experienced what's now known as maskne, or acne breakouts caused by wearing a face mask out in public. Here to talk more about that phenomenon is Dr. Ross Campbell, owner of Georgia Skin Cancer and Aesthetic Dermatology here in Athens. So, Dr. Campbell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for asking me to join you, Alexia.
So, is this just a coincidence that all of us here in the studio have been breaking out, or is this maskne a real thing?
No, it's definitely a very real phenomenon. It's something that those of us that have to wear a mask for a living have known about for a long time. Technically, it's known as acne mechanica. The rubbing of the mask causes small abrasions and tears in the skin, which can then become inflamed. It's, you know, underneath the mask, you're breathing, and in Georgia, you're breathing warm air, and that's warm, moist environment that bacteria and yeast can, you know, kind of have a field day with as well. So it's making many of us remember painful middle school days.
Right. So this sounds like this is different from normal acne, is it?
It's more of an outside in problem as opposed to an inside out. Acne, particularly in puberty, it's a response to, you know, changes in hormones, you know, causing increased oil production, whereas the acne mechanica or maskne, it's because of this irritation and rubbing from the outside, but it's resulting in a very, you know, similar appearance to the acne we had in our youth or rosacea.
Right. So what are some of the ways that we can combat this problem of maskne?
Probably the most important thing is to wash your mask regularly. I would strongly recommend a fragrance-free detergent or wash. If you have oily skin, you want to use a lighter moisturizer to repair that skin barrier. If you have more dry or eczematous skin, then something a little thicker. You know, as far as makeups, wearing a lighter mineral-based makeup can be helpful. The overarching theme is mild. You know, these are small tears in the skin, so you don't want to really scrub or use mechanical, you know, devices to scrub the skin. This isn't necessarily a cleanliness issue.
And Dr. Campbell, I understand that you guys are going to focus on this problem in your next newsletter. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We are. It's, you know, we use our newsletter essentially as almost like a public service announcement to try and help people with their skin at home. And we've seen enough maskne patients that we've kind of developed a good hand-holding process to walk through it. You can sign up for our newsletter at our web address, which is www.georgiaderm.com. There's a link there to sign up for that. And hopefully can point some folks in the right direction.
Dr. Ross Campbell is a licensed dermatologist and owner of Georgia Skin Cancer and Aesthetic Dermatology. And thank you once again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Alexia. Thanks for having me.
An audacious and almost too rich feast of an album. A sweater weather record released on a whim. Alternately soothing and soppy, pensive and suffocating. Her greatest album so far. Those are what some reviewers, including The Atlantic, Pitchfork, Rolling Stone, and The New York Times, are saying about Folklore, the newest album from Taylor Swift. To get a sense of the record's good and bad points, however, we turn to two card-carrying members of the Swift generation, Athens News Matters producers Gene Davis and Gemma DiCarlo. Here's their conversation.
Did you like the album, Gemma? Like, just, did you like it?
So here's the thing. I really liked this album because it's exactly the kind of music I like to listen to, which is, I'll admit it, generic indie music. And I think she nailed the aesthetic of this album. I watched the music videos and they're very vintage 1940 themed or cottagecore themed. So there's a very clear aesthetic for this album. However, I am still not a Taylor Swift fan.
Why not?
So here's my thing. Taylor Swift to me is mercenary. She's a more expert business person, I think, than songwriter or artist. I think she finds these genres or these areas that she hasn't covered yet and basically co-opt those fans. I see Taylor Swift Nation being like, oh, she's such a good songwriter. She's such a pioneer. And I would never call Taylor Swift a pioneer. I think she is easy to like, and we all know kind of her brand, and she just adjusts that brand to fit into whatever genre is trendy or will like make her popular at the moment. So that's my take on the situation.
You really hit the head on just the exacting quality that she approaches all of her music. She is just surgically precise in her aesthetics, which I think people like you are really turned off by. But maybe because I've just loved Taylor Swift since I was little, I'm able to overlook this.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I have never quite understood what people mean when they say Taylor Swift is a good songwriter. I've always found her songs like very basic, you know, breakup anthems or I'm falling in love with this guy anthems. And I've never quite gotten it.
Okay, in my opinion, and also I've seen this opinion echoed among music critics and also just my friends, I think her best gift is just she'll use small details and as a really interesting storytelling device. Like, I found Cardigan, I think the second track on this album, to sort of do a similar thing. I think that she can't help herself from following cliches a lot, but she also has these moments of like really sublime metaphor. I think Mirrorball on this track as a metaphor for reinvention and fame. I mean, I just think that's great songwriting right there. I do understand the bristling at cliche, and even I, as a Taylor Swift super fan, sort of like find myself rolling my eyes a little bit internally, but I do think she has really great moments.
Athens News Matters producers Jean Davis and Gemma DiCarlo.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Colin Bergen, Savannah Ciccarella, Gemma DiCarlo, Jean Davis, and Martin Matheny. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Of course, you can always reach out to us with your questions and story ideas. We're at WUGA FM on Facebook. And don't forget, you can listen back to today's stories and all of our stories on our website. That's WUGA.org. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay informed, and thanks for listening.